Accession number 22572, Reel 4.
The Reverend L.E.M. Claxton, Reel 4. You were talking about Michael Morris having been married recently.
Yes. Shall I carry on, then? Ready? Okay. Yes, he was a parson's son, actually, but he was an agnostic himself, and he found his religion really in poetry. Well, I've got a great love of poetry too, and we had a lot in common. And he had quite a gift for writing poetry himself. I mean, something like this in Secunderabad when it was very hot. It went somehow, "Oh, you who live in England, you will never, never know how we long to be in England, breathe the scented air of England, watch the timid daffodils that wander to and fro, when spring takes hold of England, kissing all the land. Oh, you who live in England, you will never understand." I think that's a lovely little poem, somebody living in a hot country, you know, away from home. And then he loved his little daughter, whom he'd never seen. She was called Jennifer. And this is a thing which brings tears to the eyes when you think of it. "The moon looked down on Jennifer and smiled because he knew God loved her as she lay asleep." I don't blame God. Do you? Little things like that. Anyway, I was going off around through this left hook with C Company, it was, Michael Morris. He was second in command. He was captain by this time. And I'd agreed to go, and I went back to battalion headquarters to collect my bits and pieces, you know, my mess tin and so on. And when I got back, there was a message from the brigadier who said, "Tomorrow is Sunday, Padre, we want a church service." So I couldn't go. I didn't go. On the Sunday, the day after, A Company, GC Company had run into trouble. They'd been beaten up, head company headquarters, by a Japanese patrol. And Michael Morris was killed, way out in the jungle somewhere on a hill. When I buried him, I had to go and do that fairly soon afterwards. They'd gone, of course, the company. I marked the grave in the usual way, but obviously my instructions were not very good. But when I buried him, I found in his breast pocket a little volume of his poems. And with this other person effect I took with me, I took this with me. And before I sent them back to his widow, Marie, in England, I made a copy of them. There weren't very many, but there were a few. And I kept that copy with me until about 5 or 10 years ago, maybe. And then I decided I'd send them to the Imperial War Museum. And they said they'd like to have them, keep them, which they did for their library. And they're there now, to my knowledge. They've sent me a copy of them. So I've got a copy they made of my copy. Well, that's the story of Michael Morris. That's one person I lost. Then, eventually, the Battle of Kohima was over by this time. We eventually got a tank on the tennis court.
Do you know how they managed to get that up? Do you know how they managed to get the tank forward?
What they'd done, and it took them 3 weeks to do it, was to build a track round a hill. The other way, the sappers made a track for the tank to come that way. Couldn't get up on the tennis court from the road. Stepped back every time. The heavy, medium tank, with the little one was no good. They had little tanks. They were useless. So we got this thing. I remember, never forget the night. The night we were getting our mess tins from around the cookhouse. There was this wonderful monster standing there, looking menacing, absolutely marvelous sight. You know, we'd longed for this for 3 weeks. And there it was, as we ate our bully stew. Next morning, it went into action. And fired straight into the... And the pole charged. Out came the Japanese running, and it was wonderful to see them. I was on the hill up here somewhere. I watched the tennis court, and I watched these little men running away. It's the most marvelous sight I ever saw. And there was another attack going further on to see the other battalion, the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and not the Royal Scots. The who were the others? The Durham, no, the Royal Berkshire Regiment, the Durham Light Infantry had gone back. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They were attacking, and they got the Japanese off the hills, off the main hills anyway. So Kohima Ridge was really virtually ours, but most of it anyway. The Battle of Kohima was really over, and we had a day to clear up and clean up and bury the dead, and I think I buried 100 men in one day.
Were they all from your own battalion?
No, there were all kinds of people.
Yes.
There were a lot of Japanese. I didn't have a service for them, I just buried them, but for our people, they were all marked, all the graves were marked. There was one particular grave on Hospital Hill, there was a great bomb crater, and we decided that we'd put about 15 or 20 men into this crater, wrapped in blankets, you know, along in a row, and we'd have a proper burial service with the commanding officer there and all the battalion and bugler, Corporal Cripps. And in the middle of this service, that gun I spoke about early on Treasury Hill found the range and opened up. A shell whizzed past my ear, and the whole burial party, commanding officer, Padre, the lot, leapt into this bomb crater and took shelter. Most bizarre moment.
Surreal moment.
That's what we had to do. Yeah. Anyway, the firing stopped eventually. I think an RAF plane appeared or something. And we got away. We got away back to Dimapur for a holiday, a rest, a week's rest, in tents on camp beds. We were pretty shattered after all that time. But we had this lovely holiday. We had Elsie and Doris Waters came and sang to us. Vera Lynn, well, she came a bit later, actually, but she came later on. But she was very good. She was marvelous, really, Vera Lynn. And one or two other people had a church parade. Now, this is very, very funny, because Brigadier Hawkins, of Fire Brigade, our brigadier, wasn't with us in Kohima. He'd gone round through the valley to Naga Hills, Naga Village. He was wounded in an unmentionable and rather unfortunate place. We were very sorry to hear it, but we were quite amused in a way, because it's not a place you expect to be wounded in. And everybody knew about it. Anyway, we had the church parade in Dimapur when we were back there for our rest. And I chose hymns which I thought soldiers would enjoy singing, such as, Crown Him, Crown Him, Crown Him. They didn't really let Belt sing properly there. Well, the first verse went like a bomb. The second verse, the singing seemed to stop, you see, and it sounded like wind blowing through autumn leaves. And I looked at the words, and it was, "Crown him, ye morning stars of light, who fixed this floating ball." That hymn went down. That's where we finished eventually. But that's not quite the end of the story. He was evacuated, of course. And a year later, when we got back to India, I saw him at a cocktail party in the other end of a room. And he spotted me and came across with his finger pointing straight at me, saying, "Padre, you chose that hymn deliberately." What a lovely man he was. Well, that was that. Now, the next thing.
Can I ask you what, you mentioned that you had to bury the Japanese. How did you do that? Were they put into mass graves, or were they
buried? No, they were buried individually, mostly. Not very deep, under the surface. But not. I don't remember marking the graves, I just buried them. You know.
Did they have any identity?
I bothered to look, quite honestly. Wouldn't have known what to do with it, so they stayed, what they had on them, they stayed in the grave with them.
Yes.
There was no means of finding them afterwards. Mm. I didn't care very much anyway, I'm afraid, sorry to say. But you couldn't do anything about them. There were a lot of them. When I spent 100 men, and there were 100 of our own people, but they were...
Yes.
Durham Light Infantry, and there were Royal Berkshire and Welsh Fusiliers, all kinds of people, really. Very bizarre day. Anyway, after that we had this, we had to attack a thing called Big Tree Hill, one of the hills which hadn't been been reduced. And this was the one where Michael Morris and his company was killed on the way up. When we got to Big, the Dorsets put an attack on Big Tree Hill. And it was a very tough battle, actually. The Japanese were the top. We got nearly to the top, but not quite to the top. And the Cameron Highlanders pushed through us to finish the job at the top of the hill. And our doctor had gone to do something to a soldier who had been wounded somewhere. So I was virtually in charge of the regiment late post, where all the wounded had been. And it's quite pretty awful sight it was, a very unpleasant sight really, a lot of wounded men lying about, a lot of blood. And the Cameron doctor came to take it over. Now he was a delightful character called Peter Barkey. He came from the Western Islands, Western Highlands, and he had that soft sort of Scottish voice, you know, from those parts. And I said to him, Peter, I'm terribly sorry to be handing over to you this awful bloody mess you see around you. He didn't seem to be looking or listening. He was looking away. And he said in that wonderful Highland accent, I was just thinking, what a beautiful view there is across those hills. Well, and then there was a shout from the top of the hill. And four jocks came running down the hill, carrying a stretcher. Mm. And on it was Angus Douglas, their company commander. I knew, I'd met Angus Douglas. He was a delightful character, a really delightful character. And I met him in India, actually, at a funeral. I was conducting a funeral service for one of his men who had been killed in a car smash. And we were at Pune, actually, in a cemetery there, the gravestones around us. And when the body, he was the chief mourner. And when the body was loaded into the coffin, into the ground, I looked for the chief mourner, and he wasn't there. I couldn't see him. So I continued with the service. Then I spotted the chief mourner behind a tombstone. And he had in his hand a flask from which he was drinking. He motioned me to join him. I told you about the wee drammy in St. James's Park.
Yes.
Tradition, I think, in the Cameron Highlanders. And eventually I joined, of course, but when the service was over. But he had lovely sort of a way of approaching me, very cheerful. Hello, Padre, how's death? And he would say, you give these to a lift. I'll go on ahead, as the hat said to the brassier. Or, if you promise to go out by the back door, if you promise to go out quietly, I'll let you out by the back door, as the stomach said to the wind. You know, this sort of thing. He's full of fun, absolutely full of fun. There he was on the stretcher looking dead. I thought he was dead. But he wasn't, actually. He had enough strength to raise his head. And open his eyes, he just said, water, water, water. It was then that the jock, medical sergeant, whispered in a loud voice, I've no but whiskey in the water bottle. However, he passed the bottle of his water bottle to Angus, who raised himself up a bit, took a sip, opened his eyes in wonder and delight, took a large gulp, gave an enormous wink with one eye, and fell back dead. No, I can't think of a better way to die than that, really.
He was having a last dram.
The last dram. Mm-hmm. But it reminds me of a bit of Keats. Ode to the Nightingale. Now more than ever seems it rich to die, to ease upon the midnight without pain, while thou art singing up thy, well, I can't forget the word, singing out thy throat abroad in such an ecstasy. Still must thou sing, and I have my ears become a clod. To thy high requiem. Oh, I've got it. Never mind. But that's the bit from the Ode to Nightingale. And it wasn't the Keats Nightingale which was singing when Angus Douglas died. It was a thing called the Indian Nightjar, I think, or something. We called it the Kohima Bird, which night after night used to screech at us from the treetops. The opening notes, you won't believe this, but it's perfectly true, the doctor and I both identified it, the opening notes of the last movement of Tchaikovsky's Pathetic Symphony. It's a descending scale. Da 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 da. And it's unmistakable, and it's sung by the Nightjar in Kohima. It's quite uncanny, really.
How was this aid post set up? What facility did it have? Was it under tentage, or was it just out in the open? And
what did they have there? Oh, no, it was very temporary.
Yes.
Very, very temporary. Just were stretchers and medical supplies and the doctor and stretcher bearers all sitting around, you know, doing what they could. Hot sweet tea was dished out. Any medicines that needed it, and any operation that had to be done. I saw Joe Chamberlain, for example, sewing up a chap who'd lost an ear, sewing his ear on again, that sort of thing, you know.
Did they have a proper operating table to
work on? No, well, they had a sort of, a very temporary one. It was only what you would carry in your hands.
Yes.
It wasn't transported by mechanical transport. Mm. What you would carry might have been something, which is, but it's very, very, very rough and ready. Mm. But a haven of peace and comfort. They say hot sweet tea is a great thing to have. I was a stretcher bearer really most of the time on these operations.
How many stretcher bearers would there be attached to the aid post?
Each company would have at least two or three, I think. And they would be with the companies. But there were quite one or two at headquarters. There were a medical sergeant and two or three stretcher bearers with the RAP, the doctor and the padre, and then just a small body of people there, really. One who brewed up the tea, that was constant, of course. Walking wounded or stretchers wounded. They had to be carried. I was allowed actually to carry a Sten gun. Now, the Red Cross issued little notes when you're operating in country where wild beasts may be, you may carry a gun. Mm. Wild beasts. Well, I'm afraid I carried the Sten gun, but carrying a chap on a stretcher one day, my Sten gun fell on his head and didn't do him a lot of good. Mm. After that, I abandoned the Sten gun. Mm. Then I got a revolver. But
had you carried a weapon before? When you were in France, did you carry a weapon?
No. Only in Burma. That's illegal. You can't do that. In country occupied by wild beasts. Mm.
Did you see any wild beasts? Hmm? Did you see any wild beasts?
I saw very little, really. I saw baboons, of course. I saw only one or two snakes. A lot of people saw lots of snakes. But I was very lucky. I didn't see much. Mm. Cobra. I saw a cobra. No, quite remarkably little. Mm. They were there. We knew they were there. We could hear them. And
they would keep out of your way, wouldn't they, normally?
They kept out of the way, yes. Mm. Yes. Yes. Mm. Yes, even tigers, I think, kept out of the way. Then after that incident, we moved further down the road, fighting our way, getting rid of Japanese on the hills and so on. Mm. Eventually got to a place on the road where the troops from Imphal were coming the other way. And the meeting was dramatic when you met each other coming the way. And we then were given a week's leave, I think. I went off with a pal of mine to Darjeeling. We managed to fly with the RAF. And it was during the monsoon. I really wanted to see that great mountain called Kinchinjunga, which I'd heard about. And we stayed in the Windermere Hotel, this Bell and I. Day after day, we waited for it, but it never appeared. It was hidden by clouds all the time. Mm. But one night, he liked singing, and one night we were in the hotel, and we were a few guests sitting around drinking, and we got them all singing a lovely song that he used to do rather well called Alouette, gentil à la joie de plumeray. And he was doing this with great gusto. And in the middle of all this performance, a lady arrived at the doorway in her nightdress, saying, "I can't sleep, please will you stop the noise, I can't sleep." So we were then invited to leave the hotel. We had a little note from the management the next day saying, "We cannot have young men shouting and singing about in our hotel." So we moved to the Planters Club after that. Mm-hmm. But we never saw Kitchen Junga.
Were the Planters Club more tolerant of late-night
singing?
Yes,
it was. It was working. It was a normal hill station. Mm-hmm. Lovely place, Darjeeling. And we went back to Milestone 82 along the Imphal Road, where we had a camp, which had been made into a little Dorset village, really. You know, we had names and quarters, warrant officers, houses, it's all named with little notices. We had fun. And to my surprise, of course, the Dorsets weren't a very religious lot. You know, they didn't go to church much voluntarily. But to my surprise, they had built me a church. This was quite a church, really. It was the pews were made of logs of wood, propped up on stilts, you know. We had an altar which they'd constructed somehow. The roof with a tarpaulin. The west end was completely open. You could have a lovely view of the hills through it. There was an altar there with candlesticks and things. And the assault organ, which I'd managed to carry with me in the back of a truck or somewhere, and it was there in position. And there was a bell. The bell was a Japanese shell case, a 150 shell case, which was hung up on a little tripod thing. But to my great surprise, the bell ringer volunteered for the job was a man called Private Curl. Private Curl and I were not friends. Every time I met him, his lips would curl in a sort of view, and he made me abundantly clear he had no use for the church or Christianity or anything to do with it. But there he had volunteered to be the bell ringer.
Do you know why?
No, well, I don't know what happened. Well, he did that religiously on Sunday evening. We were there for a month at least. On a Sunday evening, he would ring his bell. And then he would, like all bell ringers, go down to the local pub where they drank Nazi beer. Nazi beer. Zoo, it was called. It was a Naga beer. Well, talking about the Nagas, I must say this about them. If it hadn't been for the Nagas, we couldn't have won the war. They were absolutely loyal and pro-British. Mm-hmm. And most of them were Christians, surprisingly enough, though they had been headhunters. Mm-hmm. And if you went to a Naga house, which we did quite often, you would see rows of skulls and things on a string hanging around the tent or dwelling place. But they were absolutely marvelous. And when you met them, they were friendly, peculiar in their habits, the women particularly, never mind. I saw two very close quarters. They were carrying a Japanese prisoner, the only live Jap I saw, apart from the ones running away from the tennis court. He was like an ox ready for the bonfire, you know, tossed up on a two nagas on a stick, a bit of wood. And he was the poor chap. He was blinking away in a bemused way of look about him. I don't think he knew where he was. We didn't, of course. And they gave him to me. They said, "Here's your." They were very proud. They were laughing all over their faces. They gave it to me.
What did you do with him?
I sent him off the eye section. I told him where to go, and I don't know what happened to him after that. But he was no doubt interrogated, and I'm quite sure he'd get back to his Japanese home eventually.
Was he wounded or was he?
He wasn't visibly wounded, but he was, I think, unable to. Something wrong with him. He couldn't move. He'd been found alive, you see. They were the only Nagas, but they were wonderful people. And now, today, in that cemetery at Kohima, which must be, I think, the most beautiful cemetery in the world, on the hillside, it was 2nd Division, 2DIV, which I belonged to, which produced that wonderful motto, memorial for when you go home, tell them of us and say, for your tomorrow, we gave our today. There's a great Naga stone, a huge thing, built up, and this is written on it. And then all the graves around.
Did the Nagas come and attend your services at all? Did the Nagas attend your services?
Not really. We didn't see much of them. But well, I mean, they do now. Mm. They have a cathedral there at Kohima. Yes. They built a cathedral.
Yeah. Were there missionaries working amongst them?
There were missionaries who had converted them. I saw one of them once, and they were wonderful helpers too. And they did all kinds of things for us. Mm. They were marvelous. They really were terrific. And now they look after the cemetery lovingly, you see, because it's their salvation. They hated the Japanese. And they're wonderful people, really.
What were your own feelings about the Japanese? You said that you didn't care much for them.
Japs?
Yes.
Our feelings were we'd rather see them dead than alive. Mm. They were very good soldiers. And when the battle was over, we saw their dugouts. It wasn't just an ordinary dugout. It was a sort of city built underground at Kohima. I mean, it was incredible. Mm. It was like corridors and pastures and rooms. And the RAF could bomb it from the air, which they did. Our guns could fire shell after shell. Had not the slightest effect on them. They were too well dug in. And they took a hell of a lot of getting out. As I said, the only way out was with the pole charge and the tank, that sort of thing. But did I tell you about the one grave that graves people couldn't find? When I got back to Martian 82, where the church was, I got a message, would I go back to Kohima and show them? I found it, eventually. So Michael Morris has been moved to a proper burying place in the cemetery in Kohima. When the other day I met somebody who was going back to Kohima with a man, Blashford Snell, conducting a mission there. Mm. And I said, please look out for the grave of Michael Morris. See if you can find it. Mm. Amongst the Dorsets. I hope they do.
You'd been to Kohima and you'd met the troops from Imphal. You went back on leave. Then you went back to the Milestone 82 camp. Did you move on from there?
Well, we had a rest. This was about... We had Christmas Day. We had to go into Burma, then cross the Chindwin. Mm. And we were doing that actually about Christmas Day, I think, almost.
Yes.
So we had our Christmas a month early. Mm. And then we crossed the Chindwin and started moving across the Shwebo Plain. You know, the plains of Burma. There was a long, waterless place where enormous teak trees grew. And it was no water, very dry. We had to march. We walked all the way, really. So virtually we walked all the way from India, Dimapur, to eventually to Mandalay. I must tell you one or two funny stories. Mike West was our brigadier. He took over from Victor Hawkins, who got wounded. And I met him in Shwebo, actually. We'd crossed over. 19th Division had by this time been flown in, and they were up the Irrawaddy. The Irrawaddy comes down, does a sort of turn rather like an S near the Arva Bridge, where Mandalay is on the Irrawaddy. 19th Division were up in the north. We were approaching from the west and the south. Mike West, I met him in the streets of Shwebo, carrying a signal in his hand. He said, I just had a signal from 19th Division, which says that the Japanese, Burma's clear of the Japanese. I've sent a reply. I get the signal, one of my troops is still fighting the Japanese on the banks of the Irrawaddy. Well, we crossed the Irrawaddy eventually. It's a nasty crossing, actually. The Camerons made their getting across. It was then that Peter Barkley, that lovely doctor, got killed.
How did that happen?
On the crossing of the Irrawaddy. It's one month after I spoke about him. Mm. The Worcesters didn't make it, sadly. They were shot up and badly, and they came back. So the Dorsets had to take their place. Not a nice position to be in. Mm. Having known that your predecessors have lost the battle, you've got to go and finish it off for them.
How did they cross? What did they use to...
We had some kind of